Let's get... Holy smokes. Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglin from the offices of Rational Exuberance here in the heart of the historic core of downtown Los Angeles in the middle of the Art Deco wonder that is the Eastern Columbia. This is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, and I, of course, am here with my ever-faithful co-host, Mr. Phil Lernes.
Dean Haglin, how are you?
Fantastic.
We have not seen each other in some time.
Some time has passed.
I feel like we should catch up on some things.
Yes.
Of personal nature before before we launch into the news and the events of the day.
Happy birthday.
I did have a birthday. I had a Thanksgiving birthday.
You did.
Which is always very
thankful.
Very. You know what? I said this on that interview show that we both did separately.
Yes.
On the Actor Z chat show.
Mm-hmm. And,
obviously, I've sent out the links, but anybody who wants to check out our hour-long
interviews,
individual visits on-camera interviews, can do so, and we'll set the links on our official site, chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, hollywood.com.
Yep.
I'll put those in link. Those links are already up on Facebook.
Yes, they are.
Facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Yes, they are.
Might as well get all our links out of
Let's
the way at
it.
The beginning.
Okay.
And I'll put them on MySpace, myspace.com/chillpackhollywood.
Yes.
We've tweeted about them.
At dhaglin.
Twitter.com/dhaglin. I've tweeted about them at twitter.com/philairness.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, if anybody can't manage to find all those, but on their handheld device can send an email to chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
Right.
We'll be happy to forward those links and links to anything they could possibly want.
Perhaps you want a chill pack.
Or weather or traffic updates. Or, of course,
school closures. Yes.
And celebrity deaths. Which we'll get to later in the show. Anyway, I mentioned this on that show, and it bears repeating that it is really quite cool to have a birthday that falls on Thanksgiving on a semi-regular basis.
Because
it is a wonderful reminder that, certainly in my life, the greatest gift has always been gratitude and the ability to, and the willingness to be open enough to embrace whatever wants to come forward for precisely what it is and not what I might want it to be or what I might try to make it into being. But this true gratitude, and that this gratitude always then leads to real witnessing and getting back to that idea of being able to ask the question of not only what is this doing to me, but what it's doing for me.
And do they put birthday candles on the turkey?
You know, it also gives you a good license to celebrate over a period of
days.
Because I had a birthday dinner with some of my youngest friends, my goddaughter and some other kids the night before.
Yep.
And then went and saw the new Harry Potter
on
Thanksgiving before going to a Thanksgiving dinner. And then on Friday, kind of finished it up by going whale watching, which was so great.
Did
so
you see a whale?
Fun. Saw many of them.
Really?
Saw many baleen whales, the second largest whales on the earth, out feeding off Catalina.
Come on.
And they're amazing. I mean, they're amazing. You know, these whales are so much bigger than the boat we're in.
Yeah, right.
And how about this? You know, we you and I joke about, you know, the comparisons that people do of size. Like, you know, this volcano on Mars is
8 times the size of the two
Eastern
football fields.
Columbia building.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
What?
How about this one? It made me laugh, and it's kind of cool because Lily drives this particular car. But the heart of one of these baleen whales is the size of a VW bug. And so I loved that because now
you get a sense
of it. Lily, you drive a baleen whale heart all over the city.
All over the city.
That's kind of nice.
I'm going to shotgun in the left ventricle.
Go get the whale's heart.
Wow.
So that was fun. But,
that's fun.
And thanks for asking. But what about you? What about you went to, first of all, we've got several trips to catch up on.
Yeah.
You went to Savannah, Georgia.
Savannah, Georgia. The lovely Savannah, Georgia. Founded in 1733, did many of the tours of the historic houses, including those who read the Garden in the Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. We went and saw the very house where the murder took place, and
yes,
where the room
and the book set there, though the movie set in New Orleans.
No, it's set in Savannah.
Is it? But
yes.
Shot in New Orleans.
No, some of it was shot. Some of it was shot actually in Savannah, but because the house was historical, they actually rebuilt the house prop for prop here in LA. And was it New Orleans or where? No, where was it? It was in Savannah. Yeah. Oh, they took all the antiques out and they put in false ones in
because you couldn't insure that. Yeah, I know they did a lot of Louisiana shooting because they got such a big tax rebate for
it. And Georgia as well.
So they were Georgia now just introduced tax rebates for filmmaking. Did you see this? They just did. And so now suddenly there's a big push for shooting in the Peach State.
Yeah. Wow.
We were ahead of the curve because, of course, we started our documentary, The Truth Is Out There, on location in Atlanta.
And many years ago, the head of the film commission had a sit-down meeting with me to try and encourage me to come to Atlanta to film all sorts of stuff.
We should maybe go follow-up meeting, finally. And perhaps podcast while doing that. So that was the purpose of that trip was really just vacation.
Yes, well, vacation and sightseeing and see, you know, it's a place for all the family to gather for the Thanksgiving holidays. And it was wonderful. Had a great time.
Now, and then this weekend just passed, you went to Texas.
I went to Austin, Texas.
What was going on there?
Well, that's the Beninis, the art ranch, sculpture art ranch that I often go to. And actually talking about perhaps the other documentary film festivals that the Beninis are on the board of. So that was discussing the future of our documentary, The Truth Is Out There, which just went up on YouTube.
Well, no, the documentary did not go up on YouTube.
Oh, yes, no, the trailer
did. The trailer can be found on IMDb and on YouTube.
Yeah.
It'll by Tuesday, it'll be on our website.
Yeah.
But it's very exciting. The film's website. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good. And in between, you had a quick stop back here in Los Angeles to do some business, to do the business of performing the improv comedy that you do so well.
The Ghost Adventures.
At the Queen Mary, where we also shot.
Where we also shot. Isn't that funny? Yes, it was an exciting time.
Now, these were with the Ghost Hunters.
No, Ghost Adventurers, not Ghost Hunters. Ghost Hunters are Jason and Grand.
I thought that's who you did perform with.
I did 2 years ago. I performed with them.
These were the guys from Ghost Adventures Live.
Yes,
they performed stand up with you.
Yes,
Zach.
Who wasn't there? Nick wasn't there, but Zach. No, Zach wasn't there. Nick was there, and Aaron was there.
Wow.
So Aaron and Nick, Aaron and Zach. No, I'm getting them all mixed up now.
But the guys from that 90-hour telethon that you did on the Travel Channel.
Not 90, 7-hour. Yeah, telethon.
It raised a lot of money for a good cause, though, right?
Jesus. Yeah, it did. It was a big show.
For Ghost Adventures Live. Wow. They were willing to associate with you again.
Could you believe that? I couldn't believe it. But apparently, everybody came away with a positive experience about that event.
Well,
I'm shocked to say.
Really, including the guy who threw his.
Well, he was not there. Yeah. Clearly, he was not invited. Mr. Throwing the K2 meter.
And so, this was a big comedy show.
Big comedy
held
show.
Held where?
In the actual major ballroom on the Queen Mary.
Now the.
The ironic thing is that's where we shot that X-Files
episode. Yeah. So fans of the X-Files, who the big New Year's Eve party at sea.
On the time split one.
Right.
That
Triangle.
Triangle, thank you.
So that was where you performed this improv comedy.
Yeah, almost 10 years later, 8 years later.
Wow.
I know, isn't that wild?
Almost 10 years. It is 10 years later. Yeah.
No, it was...
Not... No, oh, it wasn't season 9. I mean, Duchovny was on the show. Yeah, I think it was season 7.
10 years later.
Yeah.
How ironic. You're back.
So that's very exciting.
Very, very
exciting. Yeah, did you hear that voice? You're back. We missed you.
We missed you. Come back.
Of course, you're back there all the time.
Come back. Yeah.
And you tell a great story about one of your experiences, and you show us around a little bit on the Queen Mary. And we have some spooky encounters
in
the film The Truth Is Out There.
Right. See how we've gone full circle with that?
Yeah.
It's amazing how much has happened.
I like that I accidentally misspelled improv. I think it was an auto thing on my notes for today's show. Dean in Texas, ghost hunting improve on Queen Mary.
Ghost hunting does
improve.
Because
the Ghost Adventurers could use a little improvement from what I saw on that Halloween show. I'm joking. It's just a little thing.
I know you're not a fan of their more aggressive method of attacking the ghosts in terms of ghost
insulting
hunting.
Them, shaming the ghosts into doing what they want.
They're
perhaps I could go back to the gratitude and the grace that it takes to embrace things that want to come forward for exactly what they are and not what you need them to be.
Exactly. Think of that. So therefore, you know, they're very successful ghost hunters and for all of their aggression.
Now, I feel, you are such a shadowy reflection upon me. And one of these days I'm going to come in and say, I watched Harvey Birdman because I know that you love it. And it has been on my Netflix queue. And of course, it may come up on a special theme episode.
May come up.
At the end of this year, where we talk about our favorite television shows of the past decade.
Top 10.
And I'm going to allude to that show again later.
Okay, awesome.
But this idea of your influence upon me, I will find myself sometimes seeing things because, Dean would want me to see this, like Harold Lloyd's Safety Last.
Safety Last.
And I was at a screening this week where at the Mary Pickford Center for Motion Picture Studies.
Yes, I'm fine.
The Linwood Dunn Theater. And outside they have all these glorious vintage original issue posters.
Oh, I did not know that.
And, you know, floor to ceiling posters, not what you see in the movie theaters, but really the big tapestry posters, which of course I think were, you know, like hand painted.
Amazing pieces.
An original one for Harold Lloyd, Safety Last.
Wait, the place on Vine has
that? Yeah.
You're kidding.
It's a wonderful, in the halls they have all of these. It's really amazing, amazing stuff.
Because I've been there, but
Abel Gance's Napoleon.
Well, that's an amazing poster, that.
So, I saw a film that we'll talk about a little later in the show that I go again. Boy, this is something like, Dean should be seeing this, not me, and bringing these things up. But I did a voiceover gig.
What?
A couple weeks ago, I do acting gig and a commercial.
Commercial for the Pitchman?
I did a voiceover gig. Yeah. Paid voiceover gig.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not going to say anything more about it.
So the phone rings. Hello. Are you a voiceover? How does that work?
Interesting. No, I don't know. But I guess this whole gratitude thing is working. I'm just like, why not?
Why not?
And here's the thing. Because of the technology, and I bring this up really only because we had the master of voiceover,
David Sobolov,
on last week's show. Great show. People seem to love it. And if you haven't checked it out yet, I encourage you to do so. It was hilarious and informative.
Absolutely.
But what's so great about it with the technology that we have is they asked me to do this. It never would have been worth my time to go somewhere.
To a studio
and do it.
So
and
you recorded
it? So, you know what? I set up the camera, recorded it, throw it on to Final Cut, transfer, you know, edit the pieces I don't like. You know, within a couple few hours, I've sent off what they need.
And
via email. And then I don't hear back from them. And finally, I drop them a line and say, you know, did you get what you needed? So, it's been up for ages. Yeah, we've been using it. Yeah, it's great.
What? I still don't get how this all happened, and yet I'm happy for you.
Well, you know, I do basically, hour of voiceover every week.
This show right here. So they heard this, and they go, hey.
People, but you
not
know,
the co-host, we want
I,
you.
In the past, in full disclosure, I mean, I occasionally dabbled, never pursued it. But, you know, I did do voiceovers for a couple of trailers, and what else have I done?
I don't know.
Cold calling people, asking for financing for movies, which I guess you call telemarketing. But I had no leads. I just was randomly entering digits.
No way.
Worked, too.
Oh, yeah? No. How much you raise? Don't kid yourself. I've gotten phone calls like that. Hey, are you interested in, financing a film? It's like, who is this? Oh, we got a great website and the writer from this. And, you know, it's like, what? Where are you calling from?
They're just voice imprinting you.
Totally.
No, I did a couple other things, and I don't remember now off the top of my head, sadly, what they were.
Mm.
Because, again, it's not something that I've ever particularly pursued.
Right.
Though it has pursued me from time to time.
I understand. Well, congratulations. I want to hear it. And what was the product of?
Thank you. No, it's a little history piece. It was a piece. Maybe I'll show it to you at some point. Whatever.
You know.
It's not going to make your day like the commercial.
The Santa commercial for the BX Light 1000, 6000, whatever the hell that was.
Speaking of David Sobolov, who had always come on before as our insider into the political negotiations, threatening to tear apart the Screen Actors Guild.
Yeah.
Both the negotiations between actors unions, SAG and AFTRA, mm-hmm. and then between the actors unions and the producers.
Right.
And we, again, we call them the producers, though when we refer to the AMPTP as producers, what we really mean is moguls who head conglomerates.
Right.
Not the guy whose name you see as produced by on your favorite television show or movie.
Yeah, think the Alec Baldwin character on 30 Rock as a conglomerate.
Yeah, the guy who's the head of microwave technology, so therefore he runs the television division.
Yeah.
Although I think if you think of the Alec Baldwin character, the problem is then you like
really
him.
Like him. Yeah, yeah, I know. Yeah, think of that guy without the charm or the wit. Or
yeah, think of, I don't know, think of Henry Ford, and you're probably more like it, you know? Assembly Line is great,
yeah.
And Jews are bad. That would be the sort of guy that we're...
Oh.
Did I pretty much sum up Henry Ford's accomplishments?
Ciao, cheese. Yeah.
No, I mean, he published Henry Ford published the Protocols of the Elder of Zion in his newspapers, even though they'd been debunked decades earlier, and he published them in the 1920s as the real deal. Great, hugely influenced the Nazi Party in Germany. He was a big hero of the Nazi Party in Germany.
I did not know that.
He had to recant all this later and issue mea culpas, but... You know, I just saw this movie Made in Dagenham, which is about the women's rights fight for equal pay in 1970,
right?
Not that long ago, and fighting for equal pay, and really the major corporate opposition to giving equal pay to women, and therefore lobbying governments on both sides of the pond to prevent this, was, again, the Ford Motor Company. And
bastards.
And you've talked before about the assembly line, which may have worked very well for creating the auto industry and for other things, when that methodology was applied to other industries.
The food industry, for instance.
What hell hath we wrought?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, with all due respects to Henry Ford, that's why I bring him up as an example. This is the sort of person, though, that we're talking about when we talk about actors negotiating with producers.
Right.
But SAG and AFTRA, without any, saber rattling, without any
arm
threats
twisting.
Of walkouts or anything, apparently negotiates very quietly a deal with the producers, and it's going to go to the full membership for a vote.
Yeah, I know. This was quite a shock. It sort of seemed like it was almost a gag website to call out on one of the, on Deadline News. I mean, it just didn't seem right. I never heard anybody involved. I got friends in the SAG but nobody said, oh, we're negotiating this.
Well, they weren't allowed to.
Ah,
remember,
is that why? Yeah, that's
no
right.
No one negotiating was allowed to.
So then I haven't seen the terms of the deal yet. Have you?
No.
No,
no, it's got to go to the membership and we'll both
see it.
And
then go
I
wide.
Know you and I will both vote on it
yes.
As opposed to the 70% of the membership that won't vote, period.
Yes, because they don't know, or they're out of town, or
they
act at once in the 70s as a dentist commercial, and then they still get SAG.
Don't knock. That's next for me. Next decade, a dentist commercial.
Oh. And the phone rings. Anybody looking for a hilarious dentist in your next commercial, go Phil Ernest. Just out of the blue, he'll take that gig in a drop of a
Especially
hat.
Especially if I can just shoot it myself. And email it to you.
That's like Ernst.
This is the thing. We live in the era where it is perfect for me to pursue acting now because I love, as you know, I love actors. I love the art of acting. I never have considered myself an actor. And one of the reasons I've never considered myself an actor is because I do not have the makeup to pursue it as a career.
Right.
To dedicate myself to the pursuit of it. Well, now, technologically speaking, I don't have to.
You don't
I
have to.
I can just do it myself.
You can. And just
you
put
know,
it up there.
Get a double to stand in, do all your wides. You're only going to use the close-ups anyway. I'll do it in front of a green screen, and you can CGI in the background.
Whatever you want.
Those are the movies Dean Haglund likes the best anyway.
You know, Jim Varney, who did all the Ernst Goes to Jail movies, he had the best. That was the working model. He had in South Carolina, his farm was the studio where he shot most of the commercials and most of those movies, all with his own gear and his own production company. And they were, relatively big hits, and then he dropped out of his cigarette smoke or something. I forget how he passed away.
Boy, that...
That almost had a good ending, right?
You just made it from a magical day. Happy holidays. Magical day to a somber occasion. Well, while we're on the topic, I guess the other big entertainment news
right.
that has been looked at in the media, as opposed to the SAG-AFTRA negotiations, and a lot of people haven't liked that these negotiations have been entirely behind closed doors. I must say, though, isn't it refreshing not to have things like negotiations being done entirely in the media?
Yeah.
A media that no matter where you sit politically on the spectrum, if we can say that there's a line rather than any other geometric design, the rectangle of political spectrum. But no matter where you sit, I think we can all pretty much agree that most of the time the media thrives on divisiveness.
Conflict, yes.
On conflict.
Black and white.
So to play this out in a media that thrives on conflict is just adding fuel to the fire.
Right. It won't solve anything. You're not being transparent. You are just making a mess of it.
So now the response perhaps might be well too much to the extreme, which is an absolute lack of transparency. Though, of course, the deal has to get voted on.
Yeah.
So we'll find out whether that system worked. It was refreshing, though, to not have the acrimony and the animosity comes from under the guise of simply being transparent and
honest. Ridiculous emails that I get from all the different membership factions going, hey, this is UNRWA, blah, blah.
So that brings us then to the media's need to cover an entertainment story. And so the almost constant updates about the murder of Ronnie Chasen.
Yeah. Now, this is shocking. This is a publicist.
This is a famous publicist.
Yes.
And we're working to get a publicist on this show, a friend of the show, get him on the show to talk about the art and the business of
PR publicity. And publicity and the whole thing.
This is one of the big ones. She handled many, many big campaigns for eventual Oscar-winning films.
She got Hurt Locker, It's Oscar, which was a great campaign, and consider it as the lowest... a movie that made the lowest amount of money that ever won an Oscar.
Right.
Which you would think then that is a very hard PR campaign, because this means there's a movie nobody's seen and nobody seemingly wants to see.
Right.
And yet that you take all the way to the top of the best picture.
Right.
That's some heavy lifting on the publicity's hand.
Good point.
For sure.
Good point. So she, she was coming home from a premiere of Burlesque. She's driving through Beverly Hills going past... the one on Sunset, the Beverly Hills Hotel, right?
Yeah.
On Sunset. And
she's further in that, though. Has she already gotten that far?
I think it happened somewhere in front of there.
Right.
She's found when she crashes her car into a tree.
Yeah.
Though then immediately the cause for her crashing the car into the tree becomes apparent when they see the five closed pattern
bullet holes.
Made by hollow tip bullets.
I know.
In her chest, a very tight patterning of it. While she's driving down Sunset, not a street you go slow on either.
Yeah.
It's not like there's traffic, especially at that time of night.
That time of night, that's where you open up your BMWs.
And so immediately that neighborhood, you know, it's not a drive-by, you know, it's not gang related, you know,
right.
It's not and to be able to pull off that kind of patterning, obviously, you know, it's a professional.
Right.
The question is, you know, was she really the target? Was she not?
I think
would be
not.
Immediately, because the question would be, who kills a publicist?
Yeah, who would take out a contract hit on a publicist? Unless...
You know, especially, you know, there didn't seem to be any, ex-husband kind of, you know,
yeah,
acrimonious
no personal
split or romantic split or any of these sort of things. So, of course, they went and the police investigated her files and everything. And there really doesn't seem to be any leads in this thing until suddenly the police go to the house of a person of interest.
Yeah,
the hotel. They later revealed had been under surveillance for quite some time.
Right.
And... who was basically their main suspect.
Right.
And when the police show up to issue a warrant, he...
Kills himself. Just like that, in the lobby of the hotel. It's quite a shocker.
So, and now I heard they believe they do know who hired this person.
Oh, they do?
Yeah.
Which even makes less sense. I mean, of all the
things... And they know someone else who was threatened.
Oh.
So these are the latest things. I don't claim to know, you know, or really have much of a point about this, but it's just, it's
yeah, I stopped following it until it's solved, because it's really frustrating to follow little tidbits like that all through the news, in my mind.
And just, you know, I mean, people loved her. She was beloved, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
So many people swore by the work that she did, and it just, it's just so stupid.
Yeah.
I mean, for lack of a better word, the whole thing is just so...
Because, okay, so if you think, okay, I'm going to take a contract out on somebody, there's financial gain involved. So if you're going to take out a publicist...
I understand that I live
what's the financial gain that I can possibly get out of not publicizing? So is that then my thing gets more publicized?
I mean, they're saying business deal gone bad. You know, it's like, I don't know what world I live in, obviously. It's not the world that everybody else lives in, where business is the number one reason to kill someone.
Yeah.
You know, whereas I tend to think it's just, you know, it's all such a stupid game. Why would you ever care enough to kill anybody? But then again, that's so many businesses are based on killing people. So mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, right.
You know, I'm not the right guy to ask, obviously.
No.
But it does seem like certainly an episode of Law and Order, if not a movie itself. You
right.
know, the first rule of assassination, the assassin has to die. You know, so when I first heard that he was dead, I thought, oh, they got to him.
Right.
But then when you hear he did it himself, it's like, oh, no, he knows he has to kill himself because if he gets arrested, every other client he's ever had... is going to be going after his loved ones, is going to be going after, because they're going to be scared of what he has to say. So the only way to keep everybody else safe is...
Kill yourself.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, this is the kind of intrigue. You know, hanging around Hollywood, I never... it seems to be just some nice parties and...
Let's face it, though, this is going to be on all those tours very soon.
Yes.
Deathland tours.
Deathland. Yeah.
Graveline tours.
Oh, my God. Is that true?
We do have a couple of show business deaths. I think it's worth commenting upon.
Fellow Canadian.
I'm looking at who died.
I may not know which one,
and I wouldn't be entirely surprised if they both were. But which one are you talking about?
Leslie Nielsen.
Oh, okay.
Did you not know he's Canadian?
I did not know he's Canadian, but the deadpanness of... Well, you know why? Because... From everything that I've heard about him, I know many people who were friends with him.
Yeah?
He did not seem to have any repressed rage at all, so I don't think you're right. I don't think he is Canadian.
Shut your hole! Oh, sorry. Did that come out the loud way?
Can I...
Were you not going to talk about him?
No, I was.
Oh.
Jerry Zucker, Zucker, Abrams and Zucker, who gave him his first big comedy role.
The Big Airplane, yeah.
In Airplane.
Right.
Although Leslie Nielsen, when they first met to talk about the role for Airplane, this is before Internet Movie Database, when they were casting Peter Graves, when they were casting, you know, these Robert Stack, these famous serious TV leading men.
Yeah, right.
And they came for the role of who was going to play the doctor on the ship, which they knew was kind of, on the plane,
yeah.
which they knew was kind of the best role. They said, that guy from the Poseidon Adventure, Leslie something, that's who they gave to their casting director. Can you find Leslie something?
Oh, my God.
Okay. So they meet with him, and they say, we know you've never done comedy. We love that. And he's very proud of the fact that, no, I just shot an episode of MASH. And they said, we won't hold that against you. You know, because the truth was... You know, what they were trying to get across to him, we don't want you playing comedy.
Right, play it as serious again.
And as soon as they told him and laid that out and then let him read the script, of course, he got it more than anyone else.
Yeah, right.
He really understood why it was funny. What was
that funny.
And so he then famously left the meeting, called his agent and said, it doesn't matter what they offer me, accept it now.
Ah, well.
Just do it. I'd pay them to do this movie.
Awesome.
And but Jerry Zucker wrote a tribute to him, and there was one quote that really stood out for me. Leslie was grateful for everything in his life, most especially his wife Barbaree, almost as though he didn't feel he deserved any of it. Maybe that's why he was so happy, and maybe that's why he was so good at making everyone else happy.
Doesn't that sound Canadian to you?
I don't know. All I know is that there really, when you think of his performances, and I think of his peak performances as obviously being Airplane.
Yeah.
And the short-lived Police Squad series. Everyone knows the Naked Gun movies, but go and see those six episodes of Police Squad. They're available on DVD. Good. And night and day difference, really. I mean, they're amazing in a way that the Naked Gun movies weren't.
Yeah.
Naked Gun more fun, but you almost would think that, like, the Naked Gun movies would have been the television show, and you would have understood why they didn't work enough to be hits.
Yeah.
But that they would have a bit of a cult following, and then when they made them into a movie, it was the Police Squad series that they would have made.
Yeah, right.
But instead, it was the other way around.
I know.
And the Police Squad series is just brilliant, holds up
so
perfectly.
Well.
And his performance, it's the peak of what he did well.
Yeah.
And there is no ego and no vanity in his performance at all. There's no hunger. There's no desperation. None of the things that can come in and start to compromise comedy at all.
Right.
There's
right.
just such a joyous innocence.
And by playing it for real.
And by playing it for real.
The comedy just goes through the roof.
Never commenting. Never winking.
Never winking. And it's always, and that's so hard to do, particularly if you laugh at a script and you go, oh man, this is going to be so funny. Watch this. That's when you can really screw up a comedy. When it's like, you know, people say, this is the funniest thing I ever read. And then it's filmed to be so unfunny right. because it's because everybody's laughing so hard at the written word that you've screwed it up, where he did the exact opposite, it seems. And how great is that? I sort of like, he sort of became, once he was aware that he was being funny, it was towards the end, some of those other movies. What was the one where he's the detective with the kids? Oh,
I don't know. Well, he did a Mr. Magoo. He did, you know, he did all those scary movies. He would, you know, and he would almost always be the funniest thing in any of these movies.
True.
But it almost seemed like because of that, oh, we're doing a Leslie Nielsen spoof movie. There started to be a little bit of the heavy lifting
that he had to do.
And so he kind of was in on the joke a little bit. There is a touch of it.
I think that's when lesser directors take over, right?
Also, though, it might be a process a bit of, you know, as age descended upon him, because he was a man in middle age. He was mm-hmm. in the middle of his career. You know, he basically, I'm rounding, but he had been a professional actor for 30 years when he did Airplane, and that was 80-81. And so then he was a professional actor for another 30 years.
Yeah, exactly.
So it truly is a second act to his career.
Totally. 60 years of performing.
But when he first came to it, you know, he had that gravitas of the middle-aged leading man.
Yeah.
And then as he became an older man, let's face it, the energy and the gravitas, it changes on any man as they age. And
absolutely.
Maybe that is what we're saying, because you're hard-pressed to find him winking, but there is a certain silliness of older age.
Yeah, that's it.
That I just think he naturally embodied that totally. Changed the tenor of it a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. So.
But he had a fascinating career when you think about it. I mean, before he came to Los Angeles, he had done, I think it was 150 live television productions in New York.
Really?
And these were really like the live plays.
Yeah, right.
That were, and he comes to Hollywood and they see this 6'2" blue-eyed blonde hair guy and they're going, okay, this is leading man.
Yeah.
And he signs a contract at MGM. He had done a film that I forget the name of it, but it didn't do well, but it got him a contract. And so the first film he does at MGM, Forbidden Planet.
Oh yeah. Is that
and,
great?
You know, when you first see it, partly because of the sets and the costumes and the effects, yeah. But when you first see it and you see him appear on screen, you want to laugh because, oh, it's that funny.
It's that funny guy. Yeah, exactly.
But it doesn't take long before you are really into it.
Yeah.
He's good in it. The movie's good. The themes are great. I mean, it holds up very well.
And I loved Ice Station Zebra.
Which he wasn't in, but I'm glad you loved it.
Wasn't he in that?
No.
Which one was he in then? Just Forbidden Planet?
Poseidon
Planet?
Adventure?
Yeah. Yes, which my favorite line is a 60-foot wave. Happy New Year, by the way. Just like, and it's serious, but oh my God, laugh so hard at that.
Oh my God, we're going to quote that on our New Year show.
It's a 60-foot wave.
You know who else Happy New Year. Died? Director Irvin Kershner.
Mm-hmm. Made the best Star Wars film ever.
Yeah, Empire Strikes Back. Mm-hmm. Interesting that the only two directors not named George Lucas to direct Star Wars movies are both dead. Richard Marquand died quite young.
Yep.
Return of the Jedi.
Uh-huh.
And now Irvin Kershner.
Well, but he wasn't that young.
No. Well, one very young died, one very old died.
Are you suggesting there's a conspiracy of George Lucas?
I'm just saying the wrong one, maybe.
Oh, ouch. That's how you celebrate Thanksgiving?
Irvin Kershner, supposedly a real gentleman.
Yep.
One of the real gentlemen in the business, which I think explains why he worked with such a range of incredibly gifted, incredibly famous, and famously tempestuous actors, and worked many times with them more than once.
Right,
and they all praised him. And I'm talking about, for example, George C. Scott.
Oh, yeah.
Worked Flim Flam Man.
Mm-hmm.
How about? And he worked in a variety of genres, and he was able to work in a variety of genres because of his work with actors.
Right,
because he was good with actors. Eyes of Laura Mars.
Oh yeah,
a horror thriller. Faye Dunaway and a young Tommy Lee Jones.
Ah, that's right.
Two different approaches there.
Yeah,
of
sure.
Actors worked with Sean Connery more than once. Worked with him in A Fine Madness, kind of a light comedy that Connery did in the '60s during the height of the James Bond craze.
Yeah,
and then when Connery came back to play Bond in Never Say Never Again. It's Irvin Kershner.
Ah, yeah. Interesting.
And the best stuff in Never Say Never Again, of course, is the character work. Great acting with Connery and with Klaus Maria Brandauer. And,
yeah.
But really an interesting guy because even older in his life, you know, here he is directing Empire Strikes Back, RoboCop 2.
Yeah,
which some people swear by. And
well, I liked it a lot, RoboCop 2. I thought that was better than the first one, actually.
Some people, yeah. I mean, it's certainly a different approach than Verhoeven. I mean, it is. They are different films. But anyway, supposedly one of the real gentlemen. And that is the thing, though, about Empire Strikes Back, isn't it? That it's not only the best of the Star Wars movies, but specifically it's so good because it's a really wonderful script. And it's the script that was best met by the cast.
By the cast. And that was the best acting of all of the ones because, well... Yeah.
And you had an atmosphere that really seemed to come out of the characters.
Right.
Almost that film noir atmosphere. And again, it was written by Lee Brackett, who was a film noir writer back in Golden Age of Hollywood. And really great work... And we don't see this with directors being assigned movies anymore.
Especially science fiction movies.
You know, he didn't need to be a traffic cop.
Right.
His film was going to be well produced. He didn't need to worry about effects. He didn't need to worry about these things. Those, art direction, production design, these things were going to be taken care of.
Yeah, of course.
So
yeah.
Let's improve upon things with this second movie, which is really adding the depth of character,
right,
which was needed for a second chapter anyway, because that's where you deepen your exploration.
Absolutely. The whole relationship to Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker and the...
No spoiler.
In case somebody doesn't...
Don't spoil.
No. Okay, never mind.
Hey.
Anyway, he'll be missed. Yes, what else?
A few questions.
Oh, we got questions.
We have so much to get to, and we're running low on time, but some of these will weave together.
Okay, let's go.
And... Alice Benner wrote a couple weeks ago, and it kind of slipped through the cracks, wanted us to share some of our more memorable experiences from either art or film school. I'll start with one and let you have a little moment to think about it. First is and I may have mentioned this before, but I went to film school thinking that, you know, this is going to be great. This is going to be summer camp. We're all going to be of like mind, like spirit. Let's go build a barn and put on a show, that kind of thing.
Right.
You know, and instead, at film school, it was like a sewer. What you got out of it depended upon what you put into it.
Yep.
It was a stagnant pool of hatred and backstabbing. In other words, it was a perfect
model.
Preparation for the business. And I got the reputation of one of the two most ruthless people in
the backstabbing
film school. Yeah, and... though they would always differentiate between me and this other person by saying, though Phil is always willing to help other people. But just this thing like, I'm going to do what I want to do and I'm going to make it happen.
Right, because you're a dick.
I was a little bit of an infant terrible and all this, but but at the same time, I still was motivated by that other thing of I thought we were all supposed to be pitching in and like all of us should do really interesting things. And I'll help you do interesting things as much as, you know. But yeah.
So wait a sec. This is your most memorable.
But significantly, I'm. You know what I'm doing? What I'm doing is I'm giving you time to prep a story.
I got a story.
You got a story. Yeah. So I'll just pay off this story by pointing out that significantly, though, the me and the other person that were the two most ruthless were the first two people from our class in film school to actually direct movies.
Ah. So there you go. Lesson
What's
learned.
Your story? And then I've got a funny story.
My memorable film, not film school.
Art
but
school.
Art school, yeah. Was that I was both majoring in theater and modern dance at the same time.
Of course you were.
So I had a very odd coincidence where there's two shows teching at the exact same moment in two different theaters that were basically back-to-back through a outdoor alleyway. And I had to rehearse and tech the theater piece, and then when I had one scene off, there was one scene I wasn't in, I ran through the alley and then teched my dance show by just going at high speed, doing the whole, it was like a 4.5-5 minute piece, doing all the light cues, and then running back before the theater piece knew that I was gone. That was the goal of this one day, and I had missed it by 30 seconds. And they suddenly realized I was doing two shows at the same time. And one of them, I had the long hair, and then I had to go cut my hair short for the play the next day. So that was one of my most memorable. So, you know, you think I'm busy now. I've always been busy
right.
since college.
This patterning.
It's patterning.
It's been, and it was probably busy before that.
I was very busy at high school, and yep, and never, it's always been that way.
I would... My interesting story is going to be, it is kind of filmmaking related, but it was the job that I worked to work my way through film school, and mm-hmm. I was doing media design and such and training films and things for the university.
Of course.
At the time. And I got called to the medical center where they had a television studio. Now, this is 1990, right around that. Yeah. So it was this closed-circuit television studio that could broadcast out to other campuses.
Oh, cool.
And so there was a surgery conference going on, but I get called down because they're experiencing an audio problem. Now, it is not my studio. We did not work this studio. We did not, but they couldn't figure out what was going on, so they called to the campus and said, can you do this? It came to my desk, so I just grabbed every bit of cable and equipment that I could think of because they couldn't tell me really what the problem was or what was going on,
right.
And it was being broadcast right then.
Oh, my God.
So I run down to the medical center. Into the I forget what wing it was, but I think it neuropsychiatry.
Okay, I
and
like
that's
it already.
The television studio is. I find the organizer woman, uh-huh. and we always called them organizer women because they had very specific personalities on the job. The organizer woman, and she says, "Okay, good, you're here. Go." And a runner leads me down there, and as I'm about to go into the studio, the organizer woman appears at the other end of the corridor and yells down, "You better warn him." So I go in, and the first thing that hits me is the smell. And it's kind of formaldehyde under hot lights because we're in a studio. Everyone is in their surgical gear, and I immediately see what they're doing,
which is
brain surgeries.
So,
on severed heads.
Oh my God, there's not even a body at
this. And my legs give out and I'm on the ground and the person is saying, are you okay? And they're going on with this thing. And are you okay? And I'm like, I'm, you know, covering and I'm going, yeah, it's, yeah, I'm fine. I'm just down here. I'm working.
Look at
I'm
some
working.
Wires.
I'm working. I had to look at some wires. The good news is I am always in a problem solving mode first though.
Right.
So I did immediately see the problem, which was that they were being broadcast to other sites, so they were mic'd for this. However, to be heard over the sound of suctions and bone saws, the instructor had to be amplified.
Right.
And the speaker, the amplified speaker, was behind him.
Oh.
So that had to be the problem. They were getting a feedback loop into their broadcast.
Of course.
So they needed to. We needed to rewire that speaker or get another speaker to go out in front of him.
Yeah.
That would then not be. Okay, it was very simple, and so I saw it right away. So I'm crawling along the floor, and fortunately I can do all the work from the floor.
So you don't have to go up and see severed heads.
But crawling past some of the runoff bins.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that are splashing. It's a little like all-you-can-eat seafood night at the Sizzler.
Oh, my God.
And here's the thing is when I finally get up and I look and I see some of the heads that haven't gone in to the game yet, and they're all covered in fur, and I go, oh, they're slightly, they're smaller.
Yeah.
And they're operating on monkey heads.
Oh, that's better.
That's cute. And then I said I think it's interesting that they operate on monkey heads. And then my escort says, those aren't monkey heads. I mean, they're just the human. They shrink, and of course the hair continues to grow. And it was so disturbing to me because they all looked alike, and they all that equalizing effect.
My God. Yeah. And so there was all these...
The most interesting thing, though, of all, the smell was horrifying, and the sounds of those saws and the heat, and I mean, it was... I can still feel my body, like, wanting to go to the ground.
I'm nauseous just
thinking. But the thing was, again, tasted sort of like chicken.
Nah.
Thank you.
Gah. You've just wrecked Sizzlers, chicken, TV,
Maddie Giles wanted to ask you...
Oh, yes.
With your background in improv...
Of course.
Have you ever had the desire, you've done sketch shows and everything,
yes.
but have you ever had the desire to write for a show, sketch or otherwise, to like write for television, to write comedy?
Well, I did write, we did have a sitcom take off in Canada, the pilot. Anyway, there was a huge nationwide search for Canadian comedy writers to develop an inherent Canadian comedy sitcom industry. And so the government funded this thing where they would find us. And I was, me and my writing friends, Ian Boothby and Christine Lippa, won this competition out of hundreds of entries. And they gave us a big chunk of cash to produce this. What we failed to do was go to a reputable production company. And we went to these bastards who took all our money and gave us a crappy product. So what's the story there? Oh, yeah, I already have.
You've already done it.
I've already done it. But do I have a desire to do it more? Well, yes and no. You know, in sitcom world, it's different than the drama world. In the sitcom world, it's the writers that have to stick around to 4 a.m. to get everything right, yeah. right? And then the writers, and then the performers just come in on a Thursday rehearsal and a Friday live shoot, and then they go home. Whereas when you're doing drama, it's the exact opposite. The writers just throw some script down, and then the actors and the director have to spend 16 hours shooting that thing, regardless of what, I'm sort of...
No, there are shows like that. I mean, I've been watching. I'm astonished because, I tend to watch only good television, and now I've been watching other shows, and I'm astonished at how bad most of television is because I got the impression that television was getting better and better because... Good television is getting better and better.
Right.
Bad television seems to be getting worse and worse.
I think there's a rift developing between what you're paying for.
In observing you, it seems that, because you do write, and you do love to write, but that what you write so often is not necessarily comedy. I mean, sometimes it's comedy, sometimes it isn't. But that your motivations as a writer, your inspirations as a writer, seem... to come from perhaps a different place than your enjoyment and your motivations and your desire as a performer.
That's sort of true as well. Though as an improviser, I always say it is jazz writing.
It is, right? Absolutely.
And so as a jazz writer, you love to write in this style of jazz. And you don't want to be a symphony writer. You don't want to be a rock and roll writer. You like the jazz format.
Right,
and
so I guess what I'm saying is when you write in a different process, if we can say a more traditional process, the work that comes out of you in a more traditional process takes a different form than comedy or sketch comedy or this sort of thing.
Yeah, there's also an essence of that spontaneity, that immediacy that I love so much, which makes so much comedy sparkle, which when you're writing it, it's a crafting and a honing of each word. You know, is right. it like jumbo jet or 747 or airliner, which is the funny word to right. put in this joke here. And, you know, it's a
As
different
opposed
craft.
To, interestingly, when you really craft good drama or suspense or this, especially drama, whatever the genre, you do allow then, when you've crafted that very well, if it's really authentic, for the actors then to experience the spontaneity.
Absolutely.
Whereas in comedy, you're working so much on finding the funny.
Yeah, exactly.
That it doesn't necessarily allow
for. And it's actually very hard for some people to do sitcoms because of that sort of, not straitjacket, but you have to find that perfect tone of saying the words as written by very funny people in a way that seems spontaneous and fresh.
So the second question that Maddie had, and I need you to answer it, and then I'm going to invite in Javier Bardem, Sean Penn, Alejandro Gonzalez Inarritu, Michelle Williams, and Ryan Gosling to all weigh in on this.
Wow, that'll be a great show. When are they coming?
Because I just attended panels with all of them.
Oh, you did?
And it all kind of dovetails. And so the question that he had for you was he wanted you to compare, being a huge X-Files fan, and he wanted you to compare the acting styles, how they were different, perhaps, of David Duchovny and Robert Patrick, the two X-Files leading men.
Ah.
Were there any obvious differences in terms of their approach, their styles? Not necessarily how it comes across, but in working with them.
In working with them, no, there wasn't that many differences. There was two or three cool little quirks that they did to bring themselves to the scene, like to make themselves immediate. For David, it was actually being quite funny. Like he would be not so much a prankster, but he would say funny things like, you know, the year he lost Golden Globe to Sipowicz on NYPD Blue. The name of the actor who played Sipowicz, I can't remember at the moment. What was that guy's name? Anyway, he would say when he get the script in front of us, he'd go, what would Sipowicz do in this scene? Right. See, that'd be funny. We would like sort of we all laugh at that. Robert Patrick, on the other hand, would he would be so emotionally available that when he would do it in rehearsal, he would sort of be almost really too big, so that when the camera actually rolled, he'd bring it in a little, but it would still have all these little lovely touches of these emotional ups and downs that he did in the rehearsal. But he'd just bring it down. But by over-accentuating that, it'd bring that energy up, and then it would drive that through the scene. It would be really cool, actually, technique that he did.
That's fascinating. I mean, it seems almost theatrical in nature.
Almost theatrical in nature.
Going big to fill the house, and now how do I modulate it down?
Down, exactly.
And that's really interesting because, you know, David Duchovny had no theatrical background. In fact, in New York, just did his first play. Many of our listeners went to see it.
Yes.
At the MCC, a small theater, but a prestigious off-Broadway theater. House. In fact, the man who was just named artistic director for MCC is directing Lily in the California premiere of a show that he directed in New York called Circle Mirror Transformation in Orange County. And he's taking over the MCC as artistic director. And one of the first things he's doing is slashing all ticket prices so no one pays more than $20 to get into a play there.
Wow.
He wants it to be accessible.
Isn't that something?
So it'll be both prestige and accessibility.
That's
but,
neat.
But David Duchovny did Break of Noon, Neil LaBute's new play, which was being workshopped there because its big premiere is here in L.A.
See,
it's going to be a huge production here in L.A. The whole cast in New York, they were workshopping it there, getting it up on its feet, and the whole cast, except for David Duchovny, who's being replaced, is coming to L.A.
Wow. Now, see, that's odd that he would then do...
But Neil LaBute is a big L.A. playwright.
Big L.A. playwright and done a lot of movies as well.
But so so he just did. And what I love about that, though, is here he is, you know, man of 50, and he's doing theater
for the first time.
And getting out of his comfort zone.
Yeah.
Which is so important.
Yeah, really is. I'm very, good for him, I'd say.
Because why getting out of that comfort zone is so important? And why it's so easy to stay in. And I saw this movie, Blue Valentine, with Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams. And it's infamous right now because it got an NC-17 rating.
Right.
And maybe we'll talk about that rating on a future show. But it's very interesting how it's because of an oral sex scene.
Oh.
Apparently you can have a woman perform oral sex on a woman in Black Swan and get an R. But if you have a man do it to a woman, it's NC-17. If you have a woman do it to a man, it's an R.
Yeah, I think it's called a comedy.
Yeah, you don't want it. And, oh, by the way, if that same man were to torture the naked woman, that would be an R. But pleasure her? Not in my house.
Wow.
Sir, not in front of my family. But
I see.
But Ryan Gosling was talking about the process of acting, because this is a real Cassavetes kind of movie. You know how much I love the work of Cassavetes.
And, yes.
And this is really one of those works, the intimacy, the immediacy. It's made by documentary filmmaker Derek Cianfrance.
Oh.
And it really let them live these characters for 16 hours a day on location. In fact, Michelle Williams and Ryan Gosling did live together in a house, and they decorated and they to build this rapport. And then they took a month off to shoot part of the film where the marriage was deteriorating, so that they could really go into those places.
Yeah, right.
And anyway, he was talking, Ryan Gosling, who is a young actor of incredible integrity. He reminds me, he's kind of the star, he's the contemporary
version
of what maybe Johnny Depp was 20 years ago, or Robert Downey Jr. was 20 years ago.
Interesting.
And they are not that anymore.
Right.
You know, for a variety of reasons. I mean, when you see Johnny Depp is now signed to do Pirates of the Caribbean 5 and 6
yes,
back to back. And the question, how much money do you need? And where is the challenge in that? And but it must be fun for him on some level.
I would think it's all fun now.
The fun for Ryan Gosling, and certainly for a younger Johnny Depp, is to really push and explore and get out of your comfort zone. And he did a wonderful job of describing how so much of acting and so much of the industry and the process of making films, and he kept saying films, is really from auditioning through shooting, is set up to work against the actor every way.
Yep.
And the good news, of course, is that if you are committed to getting out of your comfort zone, you can push against that, to demand what you need, to find ways to do it. It motivates you more. But it can also terrify you, and if you're prone to want to be in your comfort zone, you end up doing worse and worse work.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he even said with television, he doesn't know how it's even remotely possible to do any good work. Because it's become absolutely against that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I saw a couple episodes of Psych because this show Psych did a Twin Peaks reunion. So
I wanted to see it.
But I thought I needed to see Psych on its own first.
Yeah.
It's unbearable.
I love that.
It's as unbearable as Castle. It's as unbearable as so many of these shows where there is nothing real. The acting is completely jokey. It's
what's wrong with that?
It's exhausting.
Well, it's a comedy.
No, it's not a comedy. Comedy should still be enjoyable. It shouldn't be exhausting. It shouldn't be unreal. It shouldn't be. And this is the thing, though. And at this screening of Beautiful, the film that, you know, never mind Colin Firth, how he's supposed to win Best Actor for King's Speech. Javier Bardem is about to win Best Actor for Beautiful.
Oh, really?
The new Alejandro González Iñárritu film. Not since Brando in Tango in Paris, have we had a performance that really makes us reevaluate what we think of as film acting.
Wow.
And what we celebrate as film acting. And they were talking about this, and I thought this was an incredible comment that Alejandro González Iñárritu made. Bono said to him, after seeing a screening of this and what they've done with Beautiful.
Don't name drop.
No, intimacy is the new punk.
Oh.
Because everything in this business, everything in the form of filmed entertainment, is to make you feel okay not being intimate with things.
Oh, interesting.
That we need to break through that to get back to that empathy, that compassion that can only come with intimacy, that can only come with immersing ourselves in the lives of others, in being open to that.
Right.
And Beautiful is an incredibly intimate film, and it's carried on the shoulders of Javier Bardem. And so when I heard those two disparate conversations, it really made sense to me, because most stories on television and film are made by people who are terrified of intimacy.
Mm.
And they're made and marketed by an industry that wants to make you feel okay not being intimate, that wants to make you feel okay just being diverted from things.
Right. It's a lovely diversion, a guilty pleasure, as they say.
Well, just pleasure as opposed to real entertainment.
Mm.
Because real entertainment moves you and provokes you and inspires you. all the things that really are very dangerous. We don't want people inspired and moved.
Right.
And we don't want that.
Well,
and so just to put a button on this, when we do our favorite television shows,
yes,
at the end of this this year, you know, I'm going to criticize a whole bunch of things. I'm going to criticize, as you know, anything that deals with zombies, serial killers, or vampires.
Right.
You know, I don't dig them. I don't think Walking Dead is good. We've talked about the Twilight movies.
Yes.
You know, Dexter can be the Citizen Kane of serial killers. To me, it's still worthless.
Because it's serial killing.
Yeah. No. I don't... Here's my caveat to all that.
I
know that people love those things. They really love them. They are moved by them.
Oh, I see.
People's imaginations are sparked by the Twilight movies. People find the emotional interplay in The Walking Dead satisfying. They do. Really? And it doesn't matter that I think it's ridiculous. They do find it, and they are hungry for that. And many of the same people who are fans of Breaking Bad are fans of Walking Dead, for example. What's the other one? Dexter. You know, I hear many wonderful things about his performance, right, and about the humanity of it.
Right.
That's fine. My prejudice is that that's not going to be of interest to me.
That's fair.
You know, but I lead with that, and
right.
I say this is where I come from.
Gotcha.
So it might be the Citizen Kane of serial killer, but I get it, and I applaud it, and I approve it that these are things that people actually love.
Right.
Now go back to Psych. Do you really love it?
It's so much
fun. Really?
Well,
yeah. No.
I'm going to apologize.
Love. Love. The human emotion of love. Really. It captures you. As worthless as that is, as much as there is no heart, there is nothing
the
authentic,
heart.
Nothing real, nothing to tie into. It's an hour of diversion.
It's a relationship between Gus and...
That your life... Your life is... Anyway, so... You know,
it seems everybody's the disagreement.
No, but I mean, and the acting is just so dreadful. Just so dreadful.
It's a style unto itself.
It isn't acting. It isn't acting. It is a style unto itself.
Timothy Olsen is
it's what we were introduced in the sketch comedy of Chevy Chase on Saturday Night Live all those years ago. You know, it isn't acting. It's smarmy, jokey, and it has infiltrated every walk of acting on television.
So
it's
stunning.
I mean, to watch Castle starring Nathan Fillion, who was a good actor, and to see how everything is acted to deprive any kind of real emotional moment. And to be jokey in the case of Castle, where it's, you know, I don't know if Psych always deals with deaths, so I'm not going to say it's as offensive as something like Castle.
Right.
But, you know, to have that jokey sensibility about murder and death. Wow.
Okay. Well, it will agree to disagree on Psych. I still enjoy that show.
But the you know what Gosling said. You know, I mean, the whole thing is against doing quality acting. The whole system is set up to prevent it. And so, what's born is the kind of acting you'll see on Psych, because that is what you're able to do given the way that the system is set up.
Well, there may
to
be
try
something
to break
to
through
that.
To try to do something that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay, we'll explore that further on future
episodes. Well, yeah, I mean,
episodes.
Next week we're going to be talking about all the, you know, the Independent Spirit Awards come out, all this stuff. In the meantime, the holidays are coming up and people are looking for gifts.
Well, we got one.
And you know what's a great gift?
What's that?
Is a chill pack.
You know it.
It's the laptop cooling device. It's a gel pack that draws the heat away from the CPU and keeps your laptop computer running fast and increases its longevity by keeping it cool.
Right. And now on sale, worldwide free shipping.
How much?
For only $19.95.
Anywhere in the world?
Anywhere in the world.
Where can people find this thing?
Well, they go to chillpack.com.
chillpak.com.
Till next week, I'm Dean Haglund.
I'm Phil Larinus.